Up next, a Niagara Falls of the Arctic. Lakes of melted snow and ice in Greenland that are there one day, gone the next, draining so fast through cracks and glaciers that a big swimming pool would empty in seconds, and an entire lake drains in a matter of hours. Joining us now are the scientists who have the job of sticking their heads into these giant fissures and figuring out where all this water is going and how it makes its way, thundering through the thousands of feet of ice, out to sea. Scientists trying to predict sea level rise due to global warming are interested in answering that question, since they want to know whether all of this water may lubricate the second largest ice sheet in the world, help it slip into the ocean, and dramatically raise sea levels around the world. And joining us now to talk about their research out in today's issue of the journal Science, and to talk about the hazards of working on the ice. Picture an inflatable boat in the middle of a lake on top of a huge slab of ice that may drain itself out at any minute, and you don't know about it. Are my guests. Sarah Das is a glaciologist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. She joins us from member station WCAI on Cape Cod. Welcome to the program, Dr. Das.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
You're welcome. Ian Jockin is a glaciologist in the Polar Science Center at the University of Washington in Seattle. He joins us from KUOW in Seattle. Welcome to the program, Dr. Jockin.
Thank you, and I'm glad to be here.
Thank you for both of us. It would seem, is this about an issue, Dr. Jockin, about of ocean rise, trying to figure out how fast the oceans would rise if we lose the Greenland ice sheet and the mechanism for that happening?
Exactly. Essentially, an ice sheet collects a lot of snow each winter that then glacial flow carries toward the ocean, much like rivers carry water from the other continents. And at the edge of the ice sheet, that ice either melts off in the summer or it gets discharged to the ocean as large icebergs, such as the one that sunk the Titanic, came from Greenland. And right now it's about 50-50, about half the amount of snow that's lost each year is through melt and about half through these outlet glaciers carrying the ice rapidly toward the sea. So what our study looks at is how fast the melt on the surface of the ice sheet can lubricate it and how if that can speed up the ice and quicken the pace at which it's putting ice into the ocean. Of course, in a warming climate, you'd expect the ice sheet to discharge more ice than snow that falls each winter, and the ice sheet would shrink and the sea level would go up. And then conversely, in the winter, in an ice age, you'd expect the ice sheet to grow at the expense of the ocean, which would drop.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Das, is the question then whether, I mean, because this is what we were assuming. We were assuming that all this water rushing through the cracks and fissures, and I say we, this scientist who tell us, would lubricate, right, or make that giant ice sheet slip and fall into the ocean faster, ease its transition.
That's right. But that's only been the sort of thinking for the last 6 years or so. There was a landmark study published in Science in 2002 that showed that portions of the Greenland ice sheet were speeding up during the summertime in an area that we didn't expect to be sensitive to seasonal change or to surface meltwater. And this led to a lot of new research, which included the work that we're doing, to try to understand why the ice might be going faster in the summer. And if it was going faster in the summer in many places, that would mean that the ice flow itself was sensitive to variations in climate. Mm. And that's because the ice is flowing over the bedrock underneath, and
right,
where it has meltwater underneath, that acts as a lubricating layer, allowing the ice itself to flow faster.
Mm. And Dr. Jockin, the paper showed that it did not seem to be speeding up this process. Would that be correct?
What it essentially showed was that everywhere on the ice sheet was speeding up by about 50 to 100 meters a year in the summer, or everywhere where there was surface melt. And part of the ice sheet is moving fairly slowly at about 50 to 100 meters a year. So there it's actually about a 100% speed up. But the cause for real concern is these outlet glaciers that are discharging these icebergs to the ocean, and they're flowing much faster at 1 to even 10 kilometers a year. And in that case, a 50 to 100 meter a year speed up is relatively small. some of what happened in the past was people had observations that were expressed as a percentage. So we were seeing the ice sheet speeding up by 30%, and that was being extrapolated to outlet glaciers. And what we see is it's not so much a percentage speed up, but just everything speeds up by the same amount, which is relatively small on the fast-moving glaciers where we're really concerned.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. You can also go to Second Life and have an avatar ask a question here, 1-800-989-8255. Let's set up the situation here on Greenland, because it's a fascinating scientific bed of research, and scientists go to certain places all the time over and over again because they have information that they want to continually confirm or look at. And let's talk about these lakes that form. These lakes, we mentioned that they come from the melted snow and ice that form in the winter and then they melt in the summertime. Are you saying that scientists get in a boat and they go out into these lakes? Were you both in a little inflatable boat on this lake?
I was on the boat. Sarah was home having a baby that summer.
Well, that's important.
She sent me to go do the dangerous
work. We don't want you on a boat in that condition.
No, we're not even. I sent my people out to do that.
So, Ian, you're floating on this boat in a lake. How big is the lake?
It's about 2 miles wide. When you're in the middle, it feels like you're out in the middle there.
Yeah, it's 2 miles wide, what, 40, 50 feet deep?
Yeah, about 40 feet deep. And actually, there's some big holes in the middle that are maybe our sonar was suggesting were 80 feet deep. So it was a little intimidating sort of having the boat circle over those holes as we tried to map them.
And you discover, and in this paper, you talk about the ability of a fisher to crack open in the middle of this lake and drain it at the rate of Niagara Falls.
That's right. What we found with our instruments that we, after the team left the site in 2006, about 10 days or so after they were out floating around on that little lake, this entire lake, which was over 3 kilometers wide, did drain very rapidly through a crack that ran across the bottom of the lake. And it turns out that the lake drained its entire volume, so over 11.5 billion gallons of water in about an hour and a half. And our instruments that were left both on the lake floor itself, so pressure loggers that would tell you changes in water level, the height of the water through time, as well as instruments that were on the shore of the lake, including GPS sensors and seismometers, gave us a really nice view, a very detailed view of how quickly the water disappeared, as well as the ice sheet response.
This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And so you have this fissure, and that, from what I understand, is as big as the Horseshoe Falls itself, if you would straighten it out, right?
That's right. It's about the same
big
length.
And the same amount of water. That would be.
It's actually quite a bit more water. Yeah, we like to use the Niagara Falls analogy because that gives people something to visualize.
Right.
And it turns out that our maximum discharge of water through that crack was close to 9,000 cubic meters a second. And Niagara Falls, I was trying to look up the average flow used to be around 6,000 cubic meters a second. So it was about 1.5 times that flow. Right now, if you go to look at Niagara Falls, though, there's actually quite a lot less water going over it because a lot is diverted for hydropower, electric use. So it's more like triple the flow of Niagara Falls.
So, Ian, you're out in this boat in this lake 10 days before. It could have opened right under you. Could it have not?
Fortunately, did not. For obvious reasons, we're done doing boating on lakes in Greenland.
From now
on, we'll just go out when after the lakes have drained, where we can safely walk out there and just place the instruments on the surface rather than trying to deploy them from a boat.
Now, we have pictures on our website at sciencefriday.com of the size of these cracks, and I think we have a picture of you, Sarah, looking over or placing these instruments. Right by this crack.
Right. The surface of an ice sheet, I think people envision it sometimes as sort of a flat, white, featureless kind of surface. But in the summer melt season, an ice sheet is really a very dynamic and interesting place. And the surface is covered with little pools of water that you might stick your foot in inadvertently, streams of meltwater rushing by, little hills and hummocks, depressions, which is where the lakes fill, and these cracks. And it appears from pictures that it would be a quite a slippery environment with all this water and ice, and anyone who's used to walking around outside you know, on a winter day when there's some water might think that. But in fact, the surface is quite rough. So, you know, you're standing near a crack, but you're not really in any danger of falling in it.
Yeah, you can see the picture on our website. It does these very irregular surface. But then again, you have this crack that's, 3,000? Could be 3,000 feet deep down to the bedrock?
That's right. The lake in particular that we focus our study on, the ice thickness there was close to a kilometer thick, so over half a mile of ice thickness.
So you're looking into the abyss down there.
That's right.
What does it feel like?
Oh, it's a very dramatic feeling. Some of the areas where we were walking around, there were still big streams that were flowing into these cracks, and you'd see the water just disappear straight down into darkness, and you couldn't see very far down in them. But the most dramatic feeling was that you'd be standing there and the whole ice surface would be sort of vibrating and thundering under your feet, and it just felt like the whole thing was, you know, was responding to this giant waterfall.
Somewhere else there's a Niagara Falls going on under there.
That's right.
And you can feel it.
Yeah, you can really feel it.
All right, this is an exciting story. We're going to talk more about it. Take a break. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Talking with Sarah Das of Woods Hole and Ian Jacques of the Polar Science Center, University of Washington, Seattle. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Take you back to Greenland. And put your pitons on. We'll be doing a little more walking out on the ice. Stay with us. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A brief program note. This coming Wednesday, Neil Conan broadcasts live from the new museum in Washington. And if you're going to be in Washington and you want tickets to join, as they say, the live audience for a live broadcast of Talk of the Nation, send an email to talk@npr.org and make sure you put the word tickets in the subject line, or else the spam filter will eat it up. You'll never see it again. No, tickets in the subject line. We're talking this hour about glaciers in Greenland with my guests, Ian Jockin, glaciologist in the Polar Science Center at the University of Washington in Seattle, Sarah Das, glaciologist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Our number 1-800-989-8255. And when we last left, I talked about pitons. I should have said crampons. Do you wear crampons on the ice out there? You're just wearing your sneakers.
We actually can walk around just with boots.
Yeah. It's not that much ice climbing going on around there.
No.
No. When I last left you, Sarah, you were talking about looking into the crevasse. Are you able to track actually the route of all that water? And we're talking about more than Niagara Falls going out to the sea. Can you see it come out the bottom, so to speak?
We haven't been able to observe it coming out so far. One of the ideas we have for some future work is to try to actually trace the water flow once the cracks have opened up. So we're trying to design an experiment where we might be able to put some sort of benign tracer in at
like
the ice sheet surface.
A dye
or something like that, and try to detect it when it surfaces. The lake we're studying is about 40 kilometers underneath the ice before it reaches the ocean.
Ancient technology. I would think that there's got to be a little radio transmitting capsule.
Well, people are working on that. Stay tuned.
That would give you the depth, the location. It's got a you know, a global positioning thing in it. It'll tell you exactly to the inch where it is.
That's right. There's actually something very similar to that being designed in Bristol right now. It's called the Cryo Egg. So, yeah.
And you know, it would get stuck somewhere, of course, because that's what happens when you don't want it
to get
stuck.
Well, maybe it'll be smart enough to melt itself out.
Ooh, a little heat unit in there. Wow, we're designing it on the fly here. What the spec should be. It melts
that's
itself
right.
out. It gets a little rudder on it to stay in the water, and a little antenna pops out.
Oh, there you go. If it could serve espresso, we'd do it.
How long do you have to stay out there at any one time to do this? You set up a base camp, or are you out in tents? How does this work?
We go out by helicopter and we set up a camp. We have two lakes that we actually have study sites at. So we'll camp at each lake for a week or so at a time, and we'll set up our tents. We have a mm-hmm. you know, we each have our own tent that we sleep in. And then we have a big cook tent where we prepare our meals and store our food mm-hmm. And look at our data in the evening.
So what do we then know about where the water goes? If anything.
What we can tell so far from our instrument observations is that the ice sheet surface is responding at the same time that the water level is dropping in the lake. And what that tells us very clearly is that because the ice around the lake rises up and is displaced at the same time that the water is lost from the surface, that it's reaching the base and it actually mm-hmm. forms a temporary subglacial lake, so sort of like a blister underneath the ice sheet. And then over the next 24 hours or so after that blister has been injected, so to speak, under the ice, it drains away and that water flows into some sort of subglacial hydrologic system, either mm-hmm. a pre-existing system or it's forming its own drainage system.
Let's go to the phones. Ryan in Greenville, Missouri. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi there.
Good. I'm in Greenville, Michigan.
Oh, Michigan.
My question was, I wasn't sure how wide these cracks were and if the scientists were actually able to lower themselves inside. And if they had any knowledge of any caverns, any ice caverns underneath.
Yeah. Do you?
I'm thinking more like Aladdin, under not the sand, obviously, but with ice.
There are ice climbers and mountaineers out there that have been exploring features like this, both in Greenland and in other glaciers. People tend to wait until the water flow has stopped at the end of the summer to go down so they're not washed away. This is not something that we chose to do.
Great. Well, thank you very much. Yeah. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. And they're not going boating anymore.
No.
Ian, you're looking at whether the meltwater that Sarah is talking about is enough to speed up the flow of the ice sheet into the ocean, correct?
Yes. And that was a concern in the recent IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It was interesting, you were talking about hurricanes in the last segment and how the models don't really capture hurricanes at that scale, and that's a problem with ice sheets too. Many of these fast-flowing glaciers are only about 5 kilometers wide, and typical model resolution might be something more like 20 kilometers wide. So they're not really capturing a lot of these fast effects. Mm-hmm. So the recent IPCC, using sort of models like that, made fairly conservative predictions, and then there was a big concern that there were lots of things going on. Many of Greenland's large glaciers have doubled their speed over the last 5 or 10 years as temperatures have warmed in Greenland. And one of the concerns, again, was whether this meltwater was what was having the effect and lubricating the ice and causing those speed-ups. And essentially what our work shows is that it's probably not the direct lubrication from meltwater that's causing the big changes. Nonetheless, these big changes are occurring. It's not so essentially we've ruled out one sort of potential hypothesis for what's going on, but we're certainly not out of the woods yet, as there are really large changes happening in Greenland right now.
You have any ideas, thoughts, theories, your own pet theory?
Well, one way to think of a glacier is an outlet glacier is like a tube of toothpaste is the ice sheet, and the fjord is like the nozzle coming out of the flows coming out of into the ocean. And like my kids occasionally leave the top off the toothpaste and it all gets kind of gunked up, and then they come and squeeze on it. Eventually, that little plug comes out. And essentially, that's what's happening in the fjords. The ice in the narrow, constricting fjords is retreating and calving back as temperatures warm, and it's sort of like removing that plug of toothpaste, allowing the toothpaste or the ice to squeeze out more rapidly behind and flood into the ocean. And so it's likely some kind of effect like this, though it's not a simple relation to climate. We don't exactly understand why the ice retreated in the first place.
We have seen similar sorts of worries and actions going on in Antarctica with some of these big icebergs calving off and the breaking away of a lot of ice from that might be blocking keeping the glaciers on the shore from sliding into the ocean.
Exactly. There are floating ice shelves in Antarctica that are sort of serving the same purpose that this ice in the fjords is serving, to hold back the inland ice. And when those ice shelves break up, such as happened on the Larsen B, the glaciers behind them can start flowing to the ocean much more rapidly. I believe on some of those glaciers are flowing 8 times the speed they were originally.
Let me ask both of you, do you ever feel the ice just move when you're standing on it? Does it take a little jump? How fast does the glacier move in a day or a week or a month when you're there?
Where we are, it's moving about a foot a day. And on the faster moving areas on the outlet glaciers, it could be moving 100 feet a day.
Wow.
So we didn't feel the motion, but one of the things that we would not really feel but hear is every so often you'd be in your tent sleeping and it'd be quiet and you would just hear a loud pop or a snap and you'd think, you know, was that a lake draining or was that a big crevasse opening up somewhere? And you'd look out and everyone's poking their head out of their tent, you know, looking around trying to see where that came from.
Yeah. Wow. Do you ever listen? I mean, when I was in Antarctica, I brought my microphone. I would stick it onto the ice and hear the glacier melting.
Yeah, you could hear that, and you could hear the water sloshing around in the lake.
Yeah, I'm thinking, you know, if it's solid and what sound travels a long way, maybe you could hear the Niagara Falls by just listening with some instrument on the ice or something like that.
Right. In fact, our seismometers did detect quite a lot of that sort of waterfall sound, so to speak. We expect that our seismometers would be mostly sensitive to the fracturing of the ice when the crack was opening up, but it seems to be equally sensitive to the energy from the rushing of the water down through the crack, both hitting the walls of the ice as well as probably pounding into the bedrock below.
1-800-989-8255. Sheila in Boston. Hi, welcome.
I'm on the radio.
Hi. Yeah, got to turn the radio on and then turn it off.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
Whoa. Are you still there?
I hope you're still there.
Yeah,
okay.
Did that hurt? I hope your head's okay. Drop the phone on the floor. I have a question that may not actually be appropriate for this show about glaciers, but in terms of, you know, the ice caps melting, the glaciers melting, and so forth, I see documentaries, and they have these big icebreaker ships that go right in, and they measure, they take all these, you know, observations and so forth. Wouldn't the act of taking the icebreakers in and breaking the ice, cause more surface area on the edge of the ice? Doesn't that very fact increase the melting rate?
Ian, gonna take a stab at that?
Yeah. There you're talking about sea ice rather than glacial ice. So in Greenland, we're talking about several hundred meters thick of ice that's formed from snowfall. What you're talking about is the floating ice that freezes directly on the surface of the ocean in the Arctic. And I suppose you could have a little bit more of local melting from the icebreaker, but when you consider how small that icebreaker track is relative to the whole Arctic Ocean, I would think it would be fairly minimal.
Have you noticed the change in the sea ice since you've been going there? How the Arctic sea ice?
That's essentially what everyone else in my center works on. I work mostly on the glacial ice. We do think the sea ice may be having an effect on the glaciers and how fast they calve icebergs and suppress the calving of icebergs in the winter, which may have something to do with this retreat. Certainly in Disko Bay, where this large outlet glacier, Jakobshavn, calves into, the time that its ice shelf and it broke up and it started speeding up was also a time of quite low sea ice in the winter.
Yeah. Just give us an idea of how much ice is locked up in Antarctica and in Greenland compared to Antarctica.
In Greenland, we're talking about sort of 5 to 7 meters of sea level rise, so about 20 feet of sea level rise if the whole ice sheet went away. And we're talking about 10 times that much if all of Antarctica went away. Though much of Antarctica is considered relatively stable, the West Antarctic ice sheet, which is the smaller part of Antarctica, is believed to be somewhat unstable, and that could likely contribute about 20 feet of sea level rise, too, if it were all to go like it has probably during past periods between ice ages.
Let's go to Vince in Sacramento. Hi.
Hi. I'm still trying to wrap my head around how quickly that lake drained. That was amazing. And I've got to know, if you were in your boat when that lake, that plug went in that lake, could you have gotten off the lake alive?
I wouldn't want to try it. I don't think the odds would have been good.
I don't think so.
I mean, the force of the water as it funneled into that hole must have been dramatic. And so, right. I don't know. It would have been something to see, I guess.
one possibility. The lake actually, the lake level started to drop for about 16 hours or so before the rapid drainage. And it was a very, very slow drop. But, you know, it's possible that there was some activity in the ice that you would hopefully have detected, or some sort of warning sign. You know, if you were going to do this again, I suppose you could try to set up a warning system that would alert you that it's about to go. But it's very hard to predict when these things actually drain.
This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. So there must be lakes like this all over Greenland, then.
That's right. There are over 1,000 of these lakes just on the western margin of the ice sheet itself that have been detected by satellites.
And do you keep going back to the same spot here to study what's going on? Or?
So far, we have two study spots, and this coming summer will be our third year going back. We keep our instruments there year-round. They're set up on towers on shore, so we need to go back and download our data and reset the instruments for the following year.
Are there people...
In the future, we hope to study a few more locations as well.
Mm-hmm. Are there people there now?
No.
Work is done?
That's right.
The instruments are sitting there quietly recording data, and we'll pick them up this summer.
Wait, could there be a satellite photo of the lake shrinking in size someplace?
We have images every day when they're cloud-free days, and they do show the lakes could drain overnight. We just didn't expect them to drain in 90 minutes.
Wow, just trying to imagine that, and so you basically dodged a bullet on this one.
Very much so.
Interesting. Taken together, then, do you think that these studies mean that we shouldn't be concerned about the melting of the Greenland ice sheet? That we.
I think that's probably a little too strong of a conclusion to draw. I think that together they show us that we understand one more process in ice sheet dynamics a little bit better, and that's going to help our models constrain the future response of Greenland to global warming a little bit better. But we know that Greenland is losing more mass, more volume of water every year than it's gaining, and it's contributing to the sea level rise today, and it's certainly going to continue to do that into the future. And so whether, you know, we're going to have twice as much as we expected or not, I think we still have to be concerned, because the current rate of sea level rise is not really something that our countries internationally are prepared to handle.
Yeah, that's the one thing that, you know, you say to people, what are you doing? And they don't realize that this is going to happen no matter what anybody does.
I think there's a lot of people and a lot of governments with their heads in the sand about this issue.
Mm-hmm. Ian, what's your take on it?
I agree with Sarah. I mean, essentially, the IPCC had a whole list of things that we really didn't understand, and we're starting to get a feel for how this one particular mechanism affects the ice sheets. But there's several more that we need to figure out and try and understand why there are large changes occurring now.
You're saying that the in your study you're not finding that the meltwater here is lubricating it, but you're still finding the ice is moving very quickly.
Is lubricating the ice. It's just not lubricating to the extent that could explain these rapid changes in outlet glacier discharge that have been observed.
Could there be effects, you know, holding? You said it could be like a tube of toothpaste, so there might be some effects on the shoreline that might be keeping it back, and then it suddenly pops out and moves down. Is that what you're thinking, Ian?
Well, this is down in the fjords further down where there's a lot of retreat. Certainly big sections of some glaciers have retreated back several kilometers over a single summer, and that's usually led to a big speed-up of the glacier behind it and discharging a lot more ice to the ocean. And so it's that process that causes a glacier that might have had a stable calving front in its fjord, where it calves off icebergs for tens of years at a time, why one summer all of a sudden it happens to retreat back an additional, say, 4 or 5 kilometers. That's the kind of thing we're trying to understand right now.
Another great science mystery we love talking about, and I thank you for coming on and talking about it with us. Ian Jockin is a glaciologist in the Polar Science Center at the University of Washington in Seattle. Sarah Das is glaciologist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Good luck to you out there in Greenland.
Thank you very much.
And if you have anything new, come right back on and we'll talk about it some more.
Be glad to.
Okay.
You're welcome. This program is produced by Karen Vergoth and senior producer Ned Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our producer for digital media. And Shuman Ma is our Metcalf fellow. Josh Rogerson is our technical director. And He's not here at the controls in New York today, but Neil Rausch is sitting there ably taking over for him. Great help today from engineers Doug Patterson in Seattle and Steve Junker in Woods Hole. We also had help in Second Life from Lynn Cullins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. If you'd like to write us, send your letters to Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, Room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. You can see pictures of the glacier there and what it looked like looking into that crevasse. Also, we're podcasting and blogging and looking for your videos. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.